Hello, everyone, and welcome to CFRI's question and answer session on COVID-19 and cystic fibrosis with Dr. Rick Moss. I'm Siri Vaith, Executive Director of CFRI, and last Tuesday, March 17th, we hosted a town hall meeting on COVID-19 and CF. And at that time, there were slightly over 4,000 cases in the US, and today we have over 33,000. That evening, there was already so much interest, concern, numerous questions, great participation by our CF community nationwide, and I actually believe internationally. And quite sadly, because of the high level of participation, we couldn't get to all the questions. And so Dr. Moss has kindly offered to return and answer some of these questions. I'm very, very grateful to Dr. Moss for sharing his time and expertise with CFRI and all of us. For those of you who don't know Dr. Moss, he has made major contributions to the international field of cystic fibrosis in the areas of research, education, and clinical care. He's the former director of the CF Center at Stanford and professor emeritus of pediatric medicine there, where he continues to conduct clinical research. He's also, very fortunate for us, a member of CFRI's board of directors. So thank you, Dr. Moss, for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So before we start the questions, I must note that the information presented during this Q&A should not be used as medical advice, diagnosis, nor treatment. Please consult with your physician before making any changes to your health management plan in relation to concerns about COVID-19. And again, a reminder, things are changing so quickly and that the information presented here was current as of Tuesday, March 24th. The information about the disease and recommendations discussed are changing rapidly, and some of the information may not be up to date. So I'm honored to begin the questions with Dr. Moss. Thank you. So jumping off a key question, since last week, there have been some diagnosed cases of COVID-19 among individuals with CF, I believe in Italy, England, and just this past week, a boy in Tennessee. Do we have any insights as to how it's impacting people with cystic fibrosis and what we might learn from those cases?
At this point, I think it's too soon to draw any conclusions. As you mentioned, there's just a few cases that have been publicized on social networks. To my knowledge, no medical studies that have been organized around that. We do know that people with CF are in a high-risk category as being among those with chronic lung disease. There was a study that was submitted for public input, which is happening more and more now. Things are getting on the internet before they actually go through peer review, which is a good thing because then they can get sort of crowdsource review, which is a very interesting new way to look at peer review. That did say that in terms of severity of illness, the only two features that really predicted more severe illness if you do catch COVID-19 are shortness of breath or dyspnea and chronic lung disease, in this case specifically COPD, because that's so much more prevalent than CF, of course. So those are yellow flags that we really have to be extra vigilant as a patient population. But CF is a rare disease, doesn't really crop up in the numbers to allow any generalized responses at this point. I do think it's fair to guess that people with more severe disease in terms of their baseline lung function will be at higher risk than those who have well-preserved lung function, but we don't know that for sure. So I think caution for all patients and their loved ones and caregivers is called for.
Thank you. There's been so many questions about masks, so I think we should just address that right away. The questions, and I'll just lump them together. What are the appropriate masks that people should be wearing? Is there a difference between what a person with CF should be wearing versus a caregiver or family member of somebody with CF? Should caregivers be wearing them every time they leave the home as a protection for what they might bring back to the home? Masks.
Masks have become a little world in their own. I think there's two issues here. One is the availability issue, and the second is the actual ideal use issue. And first, we have to distinguish between the regular surgical masks that you can sort of tie on around your head, and the respirator type masks, the so-called N95 masks, which are specially produced, much more expensive. And within the healthcare setting, and people may not realize this, require an individual fitting. So as part of my job, for example, every year, I would have to go to occupational health at our hospital and get refitted with a new mask and have it available. These respirator type masks are really reserved for healthcare workers, and there's a tremendous shortage. I think most people know that people are hoarding them. Other people are reusing them, even though they're not supposed to be used past an expiration date. So there's a real issue of shortage. Now, this general surgical masks that are available really are much less efficient. They can prevent droplets from getting out from a person who's already infected. So if you're already sick or diagnosed, then wearing that can be helpful, especially around those who have close contact with you. So if a healthcare worker or a family member or a care provider or the person who's sick can have a surgical mask, that helps in these sort of more intimate relationships. Now, we're under a stay-at-home order here in California and many places in the country now. And when you go out, most people are going out for essential activities like exercise. You certainly don't need to wear a mask as long as you observe the 6-foot rule from other people. If you're going to the store, you probably don't need to wear a mask either, because those institutions should also be observing the same kind of 6-foot rules. If those rules are not in effect, then it may be helpful if you have symptoms and are coughing to have a mask to protect others. They're not going to protect you from picking up COVID from other people. Those precautions really focus on the issue of hand washing and making sure that possibly contaminated surfaces are disinfected. So in terms of who's to wear a mask, healthcare workers, people that are sick with symptoms that suggest they have this disease, and we can talk more about that vis-a-vis CF per se, and providers in a close contact situation, whether that's the family member at home or someone in another setting like a nursing home or a healthcare facility.
And what you just mentioned about people with CF and symptoms, that is an ongoing question. We receive many the same question, which is so many of the symptoms of CF become indistinguishable from possibly COVID-19. And how do people tease out when they should be seeking potentially having a test?
Okay, yeah, that's a really big one. So yeah, people with CF, most people with CF have chronic cough or sputum production. Some may have shortness of breath if they have advanced disease. Those are two of the signs of this COVID infection. But a crucial one that I think can help distinguish somewhat is the issue of temperature, of fever. So CF people normally don't have a fever, right? The majority of CF exacerbations, if we go back to the pre-COVID world, are not associated with fever. Some are. So I think one thing that can be helpful for folks with CF is to take a daily temperature and just monitor that. You can keep a temperature diary. And if you don't have a fever, it's almost certainly not COVID that you're dealing with. You may be having a CF exacerbation, but it's probably not COVID. That's the single most important symptom, fever. However, if you're having more symptoms, more coughing, more production, you may be having an exacerbation and you need to get in touch with your provider and have a phone conversation or telehealth communication about that. They'll ask about other symptoms, certainly will ask about potential exposures and make a judgment as to whether or not you should be tested for this. One of the things that came up in some of the questions you provided earlier was that someone had been tested for coronavirus and was positive, but they didn't know if that was about this particular coronavirus. And that's a really good question. It turns out coronaviruses are a family. There's 4 or 5 that cause the common cold that are not COVID-19. And some of those are on respiratory viral panels that test for influenza, RSV, et cetera. So if someone's had a respiratory panel test, they may actually be informed that they're positive for coronavirus, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's this one. You have to have a specific COVID-19 test to be diagnosed for this pandemic virus. So that's a source of confusion. And in fact, some institutions have had to change the way they report their tests to make it clearer whether they're testing for this specific one or this sort of cold causing coronaviruses that are out there that have been out there for years. So I just wanted to mention that also.
Seems like there are many different tests, just the system is somewhat fragmented, or is it one universal test? How secure should people feel about test results?
So we go from the world of masks, which is one huge problem, to the world of testing, which is another huge problem. So we know that here in the States, we were lagging in providing tests. Tests are just being ramped up now. Despite some statements at the federal level about availability, we know that that's not true. Many places don't have enough tests. Testing, by and large, is under the direction of a physician ordering the test where it's available. In many parts of the country, physicians are not even able to get that test done if they order it. In other parts, it is. So it's a very local area. And if a person is worried about needing a test, if they have some of the symptoms or have an exposure that they're concerned about, then they need to contact their provider and find out what the availability of the test is in their area. There's not one universal test. There are several different tests that are now available. What happened was that the CDC initially developed its own test that turned out to be flawed. That set things back several weeks. There now is a CDC test, but they also, through the FDA, provided a mechanism to provide emergency authorization of other private or other sources for testing. So those are now available in many different locations. So just to cite one example, where I work at Stanford, the virology lab developed its own test that's now available, and they're still in the process of ramping that up to the level that's required and also working on turnaround times. We know that in many cases, it takes several days to get a result back in general, looking around the country, and people need to be isolated while they're waiting for that result. We have an unfortunate case of a senator who was tested, had symptoms, and did not inform others and did not isolate himself for several days and finally got his test result back, turned out to be positive, and that's caused a lot of commotion in Congress. So that's an example of what not to do.
Let's see. In a worst case scenario, if my children with CF get sick, will they be taken care of in the hospital? Is there medicine that can combat some of the issues this virus may take? Let me ask this again. In a worst case scenario, if my children get sick, will they be taken care of in the hospital? Is there medicine that can combat some of the issues that this virus may take a CF patient through respiratory-wise? Are there strategies for people with CF should they be diagnosed?
Yeah, so the first thing to say about this illness is that the main treatment, the only treatment now, is supportive. And what does that mean? The biggest problem for this disease is low oxygen. So this is not quite like CF, which affects mainly the air tubes. This disease affects mainly the air sacs. It actually causes a viral pneumonia. And that means that the oxygen in the air cannot get through into the blood. So the medical hallmark of this disease is shortness of breath, low oxygen saturation, low oxygen level, and the need for supplemental oxygen. So in terms of the question of treatment of someone with CF that might have this, it really depends on whether or not they are low on oxygen. Unless you already have an oxygen setup at home, you're going to need to come in the hospital to get that supplemental oxygen. So the decision about hospitalization will involve a interaction where the physician decides whether or not the patient needs supplemental oxygen. And of course, if they're having more severe breathing difficulties, they might need further support with non-invasive or even invasive ventilation. So not everyone with CF who catches this is gonna need to be in the hospital. They may be okay in terms of their oxygen level, but that's gonna require a medical evaluation. Mm-hmm. In terms of specific treatment, I think the mainstay is still going to be treatment of the CF exacerbation. Remember, the bugs are still there. you don't lose your staff just because you get COVID. You don't lose your Pseudomonas. So if you're getting sicker, then you're probably going to get treated for a CF exacerbation, whether that's done at home or in the hospital. Some facilities I do know have ramped up their home treatment programs to do more of it at home. And the reason for that is, of course, the crush of influx of people coming in with COVID, the desire to avoid exposure for a CF patient to somebody if they're in the hospital. So there has been, I think, an effort to shift more care to home IVs and home treatment if that should become necessary. So maybe your provider would be able to provide some method to monitor oxygenation and give oxygen, give IVs at home. That's going to be a very individualized treatment sort of decision tree.
That's a perfect segue to the next question that was sent in. If there is a CF center, it seems like many are moving towards telehealth for exactly the reasons you just stated. If a CF center is not moving towards telehealth, what can CF patients do? How can they help move that process along?
So I think you just have to be in touch with the coordinator or the physician at your center and try and get some clarity as to their approach. Now, most CF centers have sort of organized their approach to this. To give the example that I know about at our place, we've moved to telehealth visits for all non-emergent visits. Obviously, if there is a change in clinical condition that requires an evaluation, that may require coming to the clinic. But in general, if you can stay home, that's a good idea, right? On general principles. And most of this hopefully can be done via either a phone call or a telehealth visit. And I think many centers have that capability now.
Great. Okay, let's see. We had somebody who works at a medical center and a franchise as a massage therapist at the hospital working with CF patients. This person sees 30 to 40 people weekly. If this person has no cold or flu symptoms, but obviously we now know you can be completely asymptomatic and completely contagious, should she still be doing any kind of work with CF patients?
You know, I hate to say this, but I think the safest thing is to not to hold that in abeyance for the time being until we've bent the curve and reduced the general lack of knowledge about how widespread the infection is. This does raise the issue of people that have no or extremely mild symptoms. You may just have a little bit of a runny nose and think you're having your springtime allergies. And that could be the first symptom. So in general, I would recommend to avoid such contact for the time being. And for the time being means for at least several more weeks until we have some idea. There is a hopeful note, and you may remember from the town hall, I used the example of Italy because I thought that was the closest predictor of what was going to happen. And so far, it seems to be holding true. Today was the first day since this whole thing started where the number of cases in Italy started to go down. So maybe, and it's just one day's experience, but maybe they finally started to flattening that curve. So that, I think, is a very hopeful sign, but it takes a long time. And it will probably take us 4 to 8 weeks to see such a response in the United States.
And how do we see the flattening of the curve in the next few weeks when, unfortunately, we're trying to flatten it at the same time that we're actually first starting testing? I mean, the skyrocketing numbers could be just how quickly it is spreading, but it's also that we didn't know there were no tests. So how is that measured out in terms of flattening the curve and knowing there's a response when the test results are showing higher numbers?
Yeah, I think that that's a multiple step problem. The first thing is to get more testing, more widespread testing, and at least in certain areas to do population-based testing to get better idea of the actual penetration of the virus. The second piece of it that's important is this potential 2-week lag between an exposure and symptoms. Now, the average is about 5 days between exposure and symptoms, but it can last longer. So that's why they give this kind of 2-week window. So what we're seeing today may reflect what happened up to 2 weeks ago. And that's why we're going to continue to see the uptick in the curve even if the measures that have been taken are effective, it's going to take that lag period to sort of kick in. So we just have to be patient and wait for those 2 weeks to hope to start to see a plateauing, or at least a slowing of the uptick of new cases. And that's all going to really be known, but it's not going to be known tomorrow. It's going to be known in 2 to 3 weeks. So I think testing and the kind of data that we have with tracking cases are kind of converged to give us some idea of whether we're on the right track. We don't know if the federal government is going to stick to that or not. We've heard some things from the president about potentially not renewing the more severe restrictions after the two-week period's over. And of course, everybody on the healthcare side doesn't see it that way. So we'll see how this all pans out politically. I think there may be different responses in different states and different parts of the country. At this point, both New York and California and Illinois and some other big states seem to be more aggressive in terms of many of the things that they've done or are implementing.
Yeah, it's been amazing watching the slow response in some places that seem so obvious. And I mean, even Great Britain with the footage that we were seeing last week and now the crackdown. I hope people understand that even if the numbers are going up, it doesn't mean it's not working. That's my fear, that people say, well, it doesn't seem to matter. I can go be 4 feet apart. let's see. Looking through these questions, ask that one. Okay, lots of questions on disinfecting surfaces. And my memory is from the town hall that you said this is actually, you know, pretty susceptible to being to disinfectant if you use the proper type. Is my memory correct? Right. And so people have all sorts of questions about, you know, getting takeout, getting their food delivered, or when they buy their groceries, should they be wiping things down in advance of bringing anything in the house? What are the recommendations?
Right. So that gets to the issue of how does this thing spread? How does it actually spread through the population, through society? We still don't have enough good information on that. There's been one very highly cited study that looked at aerosols that were made in the laboratory at the NIH. And then they measured the virus in the air over time. They measured that over a period of, I think, up to 3 hours, they were able to detect virus. That's when they ended the experiments. It could be beyond 3 hours. And if you look at the viral particles in the air, and these were viable particles, the density of those particles did not go down very much over that 3 hour period. The problem there is that they used a machine to generate an aerosol. And that's not what happens when you cough. You're more likely to get a droplet than an aerosol coming out, where there's water and the virus isn't in water droplet. Those droplets actually fall down quite quickly onto surfaces. So the second part of what they did was to look at surfaces. And they looked at copper, cardboard, steel, and plastic up to a period of up to 80 hours. And what they found was that the virus retained viability longest on plastic, less so on steel, less so on cardboard, and least on copper. So they tried those four surfaces. For food, of course, the most relevant things are probably cardboard and plastic. So on cardboard, it was still detectable at 24 hours, but the amount was drastically reduced, probably below a worrisome level. And for plastic, it was still there after 72 hours, but again, drastically reduced. What's the take-home message there? The take-home message is that if you maintain your 6 foot distance, you're unlikely to get infected from an aerosol, number one. Number two, the aerosol persistence is going to be hours, not days or weeks. In terms of surfaces, we're talking more about days. And so it is possible to have an infected surface that stays infectious. But the good news is that the likelihood of getting infected drops off pretty drastically so that the density of the viral particles goes down. If you're going to the store or having food delivered, the safest thing is probably to try to decontaminate the food. So if you're getting fruit and vegetables, wash them off in the sink in cold water. If you have a package, you can decontaminate it with soap and water and wipe it off. The key thing is to make sure you wash your hands a lot. So you wash your hands before and after handling the food, and make sure not to touch your face until you've, you know, cleaned your hand off. Now, the recommendation to never touch your face is not practical. We do it unconsciously. But we can be conscious of our handling of food and do it before and after handling the food. And I think that will pretty much alleviate the risk. So that's the way I would recommend approaching the whole food issue.
Great. And I'll put in a little plug on CFRI's website. We do have a COVID-19 tab, and we actually posted a list of products that had been tested with COVID-19 that people can refer to. So that will be really helpful for everybody when they're cleaning up the surfaces. So let's see, we had a question. If we live in an apartment building, do we need to worry about the ventilation? Is it better to turn off air and open windows?
Yes, I think it is, because the pollution levels are way down as the economy has ground to a halt. And this has been actually measured now in places like San Francisco and I think New York. They have drastically reduced pollution levels, LA. So the air is nice and clean. And if you can open your window, I think that's great. As we just talked about, the aerosols are not going to be out there in the general atmosphere. And that's a safe thing to do. I don't think there's any data about ventilation systems within buildings. That's a great question. I don't know the answer. My suspicion is that it's not a likely source of exposure. But if you have the choice, then probably it's better to use fresh air.
A different note, with more doctors trying various treatments at one time, would that greatly speed the science rather than slow rolling the treatments?
Most of the, there's a long list of potential treatments, and there are a lot of studies that are either started or about to be started looking at many of these. In general, it's always best to study one new thing at a time to get a clearer idea of what's going on. Now, I am aware of one study where two untested medications were being used, hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin, which folks with the latter is very familiar to folks with CF. So we don't have an answer about that yet. And in general, most of these new treatments are going to be one thing at a time. Having said that, there was also another trial where two antiviral medications were combined, and that did not work out. That was done in China. So in some cases, combination therapies may be tried. But you cannot just throw a bunch of things together at once and get any clarity about what's going on. And we are concerned about potential side effects. So just to mention one thing about chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine, we know there's already been a death in Arizona from somebody that went out and bought a non-medicinal form of chloroquine, took it and died. And his wife is in an ICU now with critically ill because she did the same thing. So yes, there are downsides to using untested products. And we have to work this through, as Dr. Fauci has said, through the normal process of doing properly designed studies. So hopefully within a month or two, there'll be some valuable information about that, but it's gonna take a little time to generate that.
And because of this crisis, have you heard anything about with clinical trials expanding? You know, usually it's a very set criteria for participation, and obviously you don't want your outliers. But many people have asked, do you think that people with CF will be able to participate in any of these clinical trials for treatments or for vaccine?
Well, I think if there are people with CF who contract the virus, they certainly should be eligible for inclusion in any study. Many of these medications may become available through either compassionate use or expanded access protocols approved by the FDA. So it doesn't necessarily going to be a placebo-controlled or some other form of controlled trial. So to give one example that I do know about, a local company here in the Bay Area, Gilead, makes this drug remdesivir, which is an antiviral that was tried against SARS and is now being tried against COVID. They had such a demand for compassionate use, it overwhelmed them, so they stopped that program and they're switching over to an expanded access program, which I don't think is up and running quite yet, but should be within days. So that's an example where, again, probably under the request of a physician for a hospitalized patient, most likely an ICU patient, they'll have access to that, and then we'll slowly begin to get some data about effectiveness. And that's going to be done mainly through what's called case control type studies, where instead of a randomized trial, you'll be compared to people who are hopefully matched to your particular status that are not receiving the drug, and then see what the outcome is. That's going to take some time also to give answers.
And the test for the vaccine, clinical trials for a vaccine, would you see people with CF being excluded from those?
Great question. Again, my bias is that people with CF should not be excluded. It really depends on how those trials are designed. Right now, there's one vaccine trial, at least one vaccine candidate that I know about that's being tried both in the States and in China. And that's only at the healthy volunteer stage right now. And it's a completely new way of making vaccines. It's unproven. So it's a pretty out there trial in terms of high risk, high yield kind of situation. But if that moves into phase two, they'll start to be looking at patients. And again, CF, hopefully not many people with CF are going to get this because we're all doing the right thing in terms of our stay at home, social distance stuff. But if there are people that do get the disease, they should be, I would hope, eligible. But it will depend on the criteria for each particular trial.
Right. See if we have, and I know you've been very gracious with your time answering these questions. When trying to get my insurance company to approve those early refills and to get longer term refills, how many months of med supply is suggested?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Ideally, I would hope to have for people to stockpile a 3-month supply of their essential medications. Now, I know that some medications are not, normally provided for a 3-month supply. You may be limited for a 1-month supply or perhaps even less. And I know maybe you can speak to what CFRI is doing in that regard, because I know this is an area where advocacy is important to try and make sure that people have adequate medications at home, that they don't run out. I do know that the CF Foundation has stated that they've been in touch with manufacturers of CF-specific type medications and have been assured that there's no shortage of any of those. So hopefully that will continue, and there should be no reason to have a shortage. But if your particular health plan has a limitation, then you should be trying to do what you can to get that extended beyond a few weeks. Because I do think we need to have a view of this that it's going to be months, not just weeks, mm-hmm. where we need to make sure we have the medications at hand that we need.
Yes. And just to speak to your point about CFRI, that we have, because there are the state of Washington, almost immediately the insurance commissioner in the state mandated that anybody who had offered health insurance in the state had to allow early refills and potentially extended refills. Throughout the country, other insurance companies specifically, very piecemeal in different states, have made those changes, but it hasn't been universal. So just last week, CFRI, we sent a letter to every insurance commissioner in every state, save Washington, to encourage them to follow Washington's lead and allow these early refills. So, excuse me, if we, right now we are assessing what is the best way to get momentum with this? And is it through encouraging people to reach out to their elected representatives at the state and federal level to apply pressure? Is it for our community to reach out directly to the insurance commissioners? We want to be more like a laser with this effort. So as soon as we know, we will be reaching out to everybody via our emails to ask them to get on board with us.
The only thing I would add to that is I know that in my district that our congressperson has been having weekly virtual town halls with constituents, and this has come up, and she has stated that she's aware of the problem, and there is awareness at the congressional level to try and make sure that this is not a hang up for people to get their medications and have enough on hand to get us through this.
And I really hope, you know, that the larger states, California and New York, make those changes, because we do know the rest of the nation quite often follows that lead because it's such a huge volume. So that's encouraging to hear. So a question. Do we have any insight regarding the duration of contagiousness of asymptomatic infected people?
Well, we do know that the median, that is the highest number of days between exposure and symptoms, is about between 5 and 6 days. It's possible to be longer, and this relates to the issue of viral shedding. So you may pick up the virus, and it may be in your secretions, and therefore get onto a surface, and that could be longer. In some cases, it could be longer than 14 days, but that's probably very rare. So the two-week period is what most people are using as a cutoff. We have to choose something. And that's going to cover at least 95% of the cases, probably more than that. So I think we can stick to that two-week period to be, if you don't develop symptoms within 2 weeks of exposure, you're released from formally worrying about picking up having the disease.
We had another question related to diabetes, because of course this has been identified as a group that's at a higher risk. And the question was, is the ACE or ACE effect the same for type 1 diabetics?
Yeah, so I mentioned this at the town hall in talking about how the virus infects the body. Excuse me. And this protein called ACE is a receptor that's present on lung cells, but also cells in the GI tract and blood vessels. And the virus gets into the cell through this receptor. There have been previously published information that people with diabetes have more expression of this receptor protein on their cells than people without diabetes. And there's been also some concern that some drugs may also be able to increase the expression of the receptor. In that pre-existing literature, they've looked at people with both type 1 and type 2 diabetes, and both seem to have this upregulation of the receptor. There's no data I'm aware of in CF-related diabetes. It just hasn't been looked at that I know about. So it's possible that if you have diabetes, you may have more of this receptor on your lung cells, which may increase the risk of getting the disease. But that's just conjecture. We don't know.
Well, you just opened an invitation to researchers for a whole new line of research on CFRD.
It's going to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you've been really generous with your time, and I wonder if you had any closing thoughts or questions that were not asked that you, but you have information you think people should share, or any reiteration of key messages.
I think the most important thing is to make sure that when you look for information, you use a reliable source. And in my presentation, I presented those. And it's mainly basically the CDC, state health departments, county health departments. Use the public sources of information. yes, there's a lot out there on social media. Some of it's valuable and some of it isn't. And teasing out what is and what isn't is very difficult sometimes. So it's best to rely on those public sources of information. And I think number two, related to that, is to not overdo it, to try and sort of give yourself a steady diet, but don't overeat. So in terms of sort of anxiety about this whole thing, I think you can go overboard by, you know, not turning off CNN or not turning off, going off the internet to scrounge for facts. You'll get the facts. The important things will come through each day. And just remember that we have that 2-week lag period. So the next week or two is going to look really terrible. And after that, I hope we'll start to see some good news here about getting control, getting on top of this thing. It will happen. We are going to get medications and we are going to get a vaccine eventually. We just have to get through this period. And the best way to do it is to make sure that you protect yourself by following the recommendations of your local health department.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.